Okay, so Ms. Nanny is not here. Mr. Dube, you have 10 to 15 minutes to make the main points you want to make, so I would skip over the detail, and then the rest of the time we'll use to ask you some questions. Thank you for being here, and welcome.
To present SOAR's comments on the response to climate change white paper. The overview of my presentation is three aspects. I'll give general comments that go to specific inputs and then go to make a short concluding statement. I was supposed to be here with a colleague of mine, but he took another plane. Our logistical arrangements were not well synchronized. We firstly, as the Weather Service, would like to congratulate the Department of Environmental Affairs for a well thought and balanced document that reflects the unique situation that South Africa faces with regard to climate change. We believe that the document projects a healthy balance between mitigation and adaptation actions, and we acknowledge the role that the South African negotiating team has played on the international arena, and we believe that the white paper is a way of showing commitment on our side, South Africa, to ensure a sustainable and competitive future economy that is geared towards sustainable development. The best way to build resilience to a future climate is to learn how to deal with current climate and its variability. And we know that about 90% of all disasters in our country is are weather-related. The weather and climate of South Africa is such that there is a very high degree of variability at all timescales, and the variability due to climate has inflicted a lot of pain on the society and having negative impact on property. The diagram there is derived from model data that shows climate variability stretching from 1970 up to beyond 2000, and the bottom diagram is a longer record. And you can see from the bottom diagram that even though you have climate variability, the trend is an increasing one. And most of our wet event years are associated with La Nina, and most of the dry event years are associated with La Nina years.
So that graph is saying that our water rainfall is actually increasing over a long period of time, but there are huge variables from time to time. It can go right up there to right down there, but the average is an upward curve.
Chair, this is actually a temperature, not rainfall.
Oh, I see rainfall up there. The top one is rainfall.
Yeah, the top one is rainfall, the bottom one is...
And where in the top one is the average? Have you got the average there? No.
The average varies per region. Like, we know that the eastern sections of the country has got an average rainfall in excess of...
Yeah, but you haven't got something similar as you got for temperature. Because, I mean, the temperature in Gauteng differs from Cape.
Yes, definitely.
But that is for the whole South Africa.
That is... this is modeled. This is modeled data. As you can see, those are different models. Those are different models that were used...
I see, for the rainfall.
Yes.
Oh, okay, I see. Okay, no, that's fine. Okay, go ahead, go on.
We also know that the South African population is not well informed regarding hazardous weather conditions. And we know that that has been a contributing factor, one of the contributing factors to the vulnerability of our society to extreme weather events, and we advocate for a public awareness campaign that will that will increase awareness of society to extreme event to extreme events. The national weather and climate observation infrastructure in the country is also not optimally coordinated in terms of its planning and funding that ensures that SALT meets its mandate as a national climate or a host of the national climate database by virtue of the SALT Act 2001, number 8 of 2001. I'll get back to that point later. The role and responsibilities of various government institutions and departments with regard to climate change matters are also not clarified, so you get a lot of duplication occurring. We believe that there needs to be an enhanced capacity of climate change scientists, modelers, and air quality scientists in the country. We, however, feel that the white paper is quiet on the roles of agencies and commitment from government for funding and their resources. We go to specific inputs per relevant pages. The first one is on page 15. This one has got to do with water resources. There's a statement on page 15 that says, based on current projections, South Africa will exceed the limits of economically viable land-based water resources by 2015. Actually, if you make a reference to the third assessment report of the IPCC of 2001, it indicates that South Africa will be water scarce by the year 2050, but if you put other factors, your rate of economic development, your urbanization, your rate of population growth, and on top of that you factor in climate change, that shrinks to 2025. This is coming from the third assessment report of the IPCC. We as the South African Weather Service have had programs where we interact with our users of our products, such as people in the Department of Agriculture, Water Affairs, etc. And we are trying, out of the two workshops that we had since 2010, we are trying to get tailor-made products emanating from those workshops. This is what I was talking about. If you look here, unfortunately I left my glasses at home. If you look, I think that is South Africa over there. Currently, if you look, there we are above the 1,000 per cubic, this a threshold of 1,000 cubic meters per year, which is a limit for scarcity. But if you go to 2025, factoring climate change, we fall below that threshold of 1,000 cubic meters per capita. It's something to worry about. And of course, the situation is replicated throughout most of the continent. Then going to a comment on page 17 of the white paper, we believe that the section 5.2.5 should be expanded to include augmentation technologies such as rainfall enhancement, and we've got a wording there because that statement as it is currently does not recognize the augmentation technologies and there are capabilities in that regard. And a lot of research is going on throughout the world in that regard. Another concern is in the construction in our major cities.
You have 7 minutes left.
Okay, then comment on page 8 of the white paper. There's a statement to do with air quality, and we believe that that statement should in a way be toned down to show some sensitivity to people who are sensitive to air pollution or people who are living in air pollution hotspots, because if those people see a statement that says South Africa's air is generally good, they will exclude generally and they will read it as South Africa's air quality is good. So perhaps to say South Africa's background air pollution levels are low will be toning down, which should be acceptable. And of course, the next statement put some background into our air pollution problems in the country, both indoor and outdoor. Then on page 26, with regard to energy, that basically talks about mitigation options. We want to highlight a point there. I'm not going to read because of the time factor. We want to highlight the fact that there are alternative energy sources like your wind energy, which is abundant in South Africa. According to WMO, if the wind speed is above 3 meters per second, you can easily harness per annum. You can easily harness you have sufficient wind energy to harness under those circumstances. And under that prescript, most of South Africa will qualify as an area for harnessing wind energy. Then on page 39, there's a section that deals with South Africa will use section 29(1) of the Air Quality Act to manage greenhouse gas emissions from all industry sources. We believe that there should be recognition there that is placed on non-industrial sources such as vehicle emissions, which have got a significant impact on the environment and health. Then a section on page 44 to do with financing the National Climate Change Response Policy, establishing or support public platforms to assimilate and disseminate climate science information. We believe that as the South African Weather Service, we've got a role to play there as a well-renowned institution of climate science and as an institution that has got a mandate from government to perform with regard to climate and weather. On page 44 to do with education, we highlight the fact that climate science is a complex field, it's a specialized field, and we as the South African Weather Service needs to get that recognition. We need to play our role. We've got a training center that trains modelers, forecasters, and researchers, and recently we've been recognized by the World Meteorological Organization as the regional training center for SADC. And we believe that when it comes to education, we should play a leading coordinating role in that respect. On page 45, highly informed decision making, there is a proposal in the white paper for a chief scientific advisor in the Ministry of Science and Technology. We are advocating that there be two of those. There's a need for chief scientific advisors, one on the science side of climate change and one on the technology side of things. And we believe that the advisory council, as proposed in the white paper, to be appointed by the chief scientific advisor should actually be a role that is performed by the minister. Because from where we are seated, scientists in South Africa tend to behave in a cliquey manner. So we believe that minister will play kind of an oversight role in knowing which expertise is needed throughout the country. Monitoring climate role, again here, we are highlighting the role of the South African Weather Service in as far as monitoring is concerned with regard to observation data, archival, we've got data dating more than 150 years on our database, we've got a role to play there. So what we are saying is with regard to observation data, archival, analysis and climate research roles that we play, they are critical for gauging changes in the climate base. In conclusion, we as the South African Weather Service accept the white paper, and we are aware that some of the points that we raise here are points to be taken up at implementation. According to the white paper, there is the IMCCC and IGCCC structure that are established. Perhaps some of these things belong there. We do not believe that what we have raised here will in any way stop progress with regard to going forward with the white paper. I've highlighted a well-resourced and capable Met Service, National Met Service, NMS, will form a critical link in building resilience against the impact of future climate in South Africa. And in this regard, cognizance should be taken of the fact that we as the Weather Service are a smaller weather service. We are small by international standards, considering the area that we cover as well, both terrestrial and marine. We've got a responsibility to cover as well as the complexity of our climate and weather. Our climate system is not simple. We are also committed to continuing improving our early warning system. as well as our marine forecast and modeling, and we are proud to say we've got an even more bigger role to play as we have the one of the 26 GAW stations here in the Cape, and we are now being given a mandate to host SAQIS, the South African Air Quality Information System, and SAQIS 2 that we are physically rocking now is on the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory, which is important in terms of meeting our national and international obligations in terms of the UNFCCC. I want to conclude with a statement. I wrote this when I was in the plane this morning. It's an extract from the minister, her opinion on the forthcoming COP17, the Star of Wednesday the 9th, on page 9. She says the policy outlined in the white paper serves as the embodiment of our government to a fair contribution to the stabilization of global greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere and the protection of the country and its people from the impacts of climate change. This is, among others, a decisive action based on the acknowledgement that our economic development is vital but must go hand in hand with conserving the environment. We fully subscribe to this statement, and as I've said before, we fully support the white paper. We believe that the comments that I've articulated are things that can be taken up at the implementation phase of the white paper. Thank you, Chair.
Edna, take the A away and put your H at the end.
I'll do that, Chair.
Fix it up, else you're going to get into trouble with your own minister. Thank you very much. I think there are very lot of useful practical issues. As you say, most of your things are more in the implementation, so, but it's still important. All right, questions? Any questions? Inputs? Chairperson Njikalana? Mr. Skosana? Mr. Tete?
Thank you very much, Chair. Also, let me commend the weather services for their input, particularly illustrating that they definitely have a role to play in responding to the climate change. My question is, they refer to 90% of all disasters are weather-related. Just out of interest, to the 10%, where would you categorize it, or how would you categorize it? Also, it's good to know that the Wind Atlas in South Africa shows that we have, you know, quite a sizable amount, you know, that of wind, that would ensure that we source wind energy. But on the same breath, an impression has been given. I'm speaking anecdotally here, Chair, that solar energy is just as strong. If you could comment on that. The last point is around the assertion that the Weather Service is putting around being able to coordinate national efforts on climate change and adaptation research. Now, does that mean that the Weather Services would be playing that role on its own? My question is loaded, Chair, because I know CSIR does a lot of work in that area, and CSIR is also a government entity. Thank you.
Mr. Rosan. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, let me start by welcoming the input made by the South African Weather Services. And I must say, there are a lot of positive issues that they have raised in their presentation. But Chairperson, I just want to know, as we know that most of the disasters in South Africa are weather-related, as the presenter has said. I want to know about these early warning systems. At some stage, we talk about these warning systems in the rural areas. How do we research people to to know exactly when these things will be happening. Because if you can you can check thoroughly to the disasters that happened in this country are happening mostly in the rural areas. Thank you.
Mr. Tetsu.
I maintain that we're not going to respond as a nation properly to climate change, no matter how good our policies are, until we've got a decent database to capture all the relevant information we need to be able to make scientific and rational decisions about climate change. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about climate change. I mean, everything that the climate throws at us is not necessarily climate change. In fact, no one can link specific events. The tornadoes we had recently, we can't link that specifically to climate change. Climate change is actually a phenomenon of the whole world warming up. And we know that the consequences of that warming up is that when something is warmer than it used to be previously, the weather acts in a different way. The way the air flows is different, the way the water goes is different, but that is, and that the more, the hotter it gets, the more we may start saying, well, excessive weather may be a consequence, but there's no specific links to it. And so really it's the issue about trying to mitigate that we warm the world. That's what it's all about. And database is important. So this thing you mentioned, the National Climate Database, I want you to explain to me, I want to come and actually look at it, what is all the data we've got there? Is it only the weather data that you guys have been collecting over many years, or does it go broader than that? Just give us some explanation of what kind of information there, and what is the kind of thing that we can start gleaning from that, in terms of information, where we can base policies on it. Let's leave it to that. Let's see your responses. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. My colleague has arrived, Mr. Nico Cruze. He's going to help me with some of the questions. Maybe if I can start from the bottom up. The National Climate Database hosts data that last year we were celebrating 150 years of existence of the South African Weather Service in our collection of data. We are very, very lucky in South Africa that we've got such a database, because it's critical for decision making, and it's critical for establishing trends. We have a group of scientists in my division that are working on data from the database, because just to verify what is being given by models. We have established some of the research work that has come out of that. I've seen it in a number of documents of the Department of Environmental Affairs. For example, the observation that your rainfall over the country from inside to observation is patchy. The temperature trend, we know the temperature trend from all stations in the country is an upward trend, but with regard to rainfall, the pattern is very patchy. We only see a coherent picture in the area that surrounds Lesotho, where temperature is significantly increasing if we analyze data on the database. Otherwise, throughout the country, the trend is patchy. But models are indicating that the eastern sections of the country, the eastern seaboard of KZN, will be wetter, whilst the western sections of the country will be drier. That is a fact that all scientists have agreed upon. So the data that we're storing currently is on the National Climate Data.
Temperature. Rain.
Rainfall. Humidity.
Humidity.
Pressure. Atmospheric pressure.
Pressure.
Wind.
Wind.
lightning?
We
is there where
yes, we do have LDM data, we do have lightning data, but it does it's not 150 years old.
It's more recent.
More recent,
yeah.
Technology. Yes. So,
so most of the all the information you can get from climate and weather, you guys have got in that database, and it can give you a whole lot of models, and it can trace into the future and backwards, etc., etc. There's a full model that you have on your database.
Yes, we do have that, and on top of that, there's something I alluded to that we will now be storing air quality data from throughout the country, both ambient air quality as well as greenhouse gas inventory, which are important in terms of UN. FCCC reporting. We also have GAW, Global Atmosphere Watch Station here in Cape Town. It's one of the 25 stations in the world and only one of the two in Africa. So it's something that we are very, very proud of. We relay data from those stations to the national data centers. And they are a feed into these reports on IP or your IPCC report. So what you see on
and that information we feed into those international ones. Do we have full access to that international data?
Yes.
So being part of it gives us access to the whole
international. Yes, we have access to the international data.
Okay.
We can also access it through our GAW station here in Cape Point.
Mm. Okay. Did you want to add something on the database before you answer the other question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry for being late. But just to add to what my colleague, Professor Lawrence Dube, has said about the normal meteorological parameters that are being archived on our database, we also archive what we call unconventional data, which is the lightning data, which he has alluded to, coming from a network that we've installed in 2006. Obviously a very short record. It's not, in order to actually deduct some climate information from it, you need at least 11 years, preferably 30 years, and preferably more. But so that is a very short database. Then we also are in the process of installing a radar network. So that data is also being captured at the moment, and then also satellite, meteorological satellite data that we are recording. And then the Weather Service is also in the implementation phase, although it has had a network of solar radiation stations. It's also enhancing that network, solar radiation being very important in the energy sector for generation of solar energy.
That is how much sunshine we have at a particular time in a particular place.
Yeah.
Exactly the question that the chair was alluding to.
Yeah.
Starts giving us patterns of sunshine and availability or whether it's increasing or decreasing.
It also gives you information on whether the cloud cover over an area, mm-hmm. whether that increases or decreases.
Okay. That sounds good. Okay, the other questions that were asked?
There's a statement that you said, Chair, which is very, very critical, that no one can link specific events to climate change. It's a very, very critical statement, that one. And I've had this question many times at interviews, and the way I answer it is people tend to relate climate change to disasters. If you look at the population of South Africa in 1960, it was seated at about 16 million, and today we are about 50 million. So within a very short space of time, our population has tripled. Coupled with that, you find people for socio-economic reasons located along floodplains. You find people in coastal cities building below the waterline, the shoreline. That increases vulnerability of people to extreme weather events. So within the vulnerability factor is also the question of planning that we need to take into account.
Especially at local government level.
Yeah. The WMO is developing a methodology of indices to gauge climate change, something that we should be having within 3 to 5 years to look at, for instance, the index of tropical cyclone activity as to whether it's increasing or decreasing, so that we have a scientific basis to say with confidence that your tropical cyclonic activity, for instance, over the Indian Ocean is increasing or decreasing. Okay, my colleague wants to add something.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, regarding the question of how will the man in the street feel climate change? Because, as you said, there's a lot of misunderstanding about climate change, and whether we predict a 2 centigrade rise in temperature in 50 years' time or 4 degrees in 100 years' time, we are not going to change our behavioral patterns due to a forecast like that. The way that we are going to experience, I want to call it climate change, but is within the day-to-day weather events, when that exceeds some extremes that we as humans are not capable to handle, if that exceedance levels are exceeded, then we have we need to respond. So our response will be on short-term weather events that exceed certain extremes that we are not able to handle.
The way we'll probably feel it is not necessarily through violent climatic instance. It'll be, as you said, the rest of the country will start getting dry. Our dams will get emptier and emptier. We'll have to find ways to get water to the west of the country. That we'll see as a country, and the money patterns will have to start changing and doing that. Certain crops that we rely on as a nation to feed our nation, the weather will start changing. You can't put those crops we used to plant them. It's those things that are actually going to start showing when the weather climate change. It won't necessarily be through specific climatic events, unless they become so frequent that, you know, every day we're facing a cyclone somewhere in the country or the world. But I think it's more, that's why we need the databases, because the only way we're going to establish those kind of things is the kind of amount of water we've had at a certain place, the amount of crops we used to grow. We'll actually see how that's starting to change. That'll show us where we're living is changing. So your indices to start developing that becomes very vital. I want to follow up on that one, okay? All right, the other questions?
Was a question from Honorable Mr. Skosana on disasters that are weather-related, as well as any warning systems in rural areas. How do we reach such areas? I think Nico will be well placed because he's our disaster management expert at the South African Weather Service. Shall I give this to you, Nico?
Mr. Chairman, the question that was put to us was quite relevant. It is very true that people in the rural areas are basically very vulnerable to extreme weather events. And if climate change is going to change the pattern, and what we do expect is that the intensity of weather events will increase. In other words, our rainfall patterns, you will have more floods, but intense floods, and you'll have more droughts and more intense droughts. So that is the long-range outlook. And that, as you quite can imagine, is what will affect especially the people in the rural area pertinently. And that is why I think hopefully one of the suggestions that was made by Lawrence in his presentation is that the population in the rural areas is not very well informed on how to react to specifically extreme weather events. You'll find that the death toll in South Africa due to extreme weather events is much higher
than the world average, and that is basically due to a lack of education on how to react to incidents of severe weather. Our death toll in lightning-related events is 16 times higher than the world average. So it shows that people don't know what to do in certain instances. And there's a big, and in the white paper, there is.
I think we accept that, but I think what Mrs. Kasana is raising is, you see, I don't think our warning systems are good enough. If you go to a place like America and so on, and you put the TV on or you put the radio on, and there's weather coming along, there's either a little thing in the corner there telling you there's a storm coming or there's a tornado coming. And what we're really looking for is people like the weather services and the disaster management system to start finding innovative ways, particularly to let poor and those communities. I mean, is the best way, for example, to inform immediate alerts go to the local government, to the police station in the area? Automatic. You know, yesterday, during my public hearing, Cecil and the Chamber of Mines gave evidence yesterday. Before they left the room, I already got a news flash on here. Chamber of Mines and Cecil raising problems with white paper, which wasn't correct, but you know, at least there was a news flash. Now, the problem is that is what I want to see. When you identify in the weather services that there's something coming, that thing must be put on phones, on whatever, the TVs. That's what we're talking about. I agree with you, ultimately, is we're going to have to educate and capacitate our people to respond to those. And it's difficult, particularly for poor people. I mean, if you live in a depressed area where the water is going to come through, it's very difficult to respond. Because, but at least, in an early warning, people are not dying because the water caught them in a place where they should. That shouldn't happen. So, you know, that's what I think Mr. Skosana is asking more, is what are we going to do? We accept we have to capacitate our people. But what do we do to fix up our system that you guys are more innovative in terms of giving this information earlier? You see, we can start holding a local government responsible if they knew 5 hours before the time that there's something coming and they didn't even take the chance to someone drive into a squatter area to go and say, but hey, there's rain coming here, people, let's get out of here, let's go into high ground. Then we can start then saying that we, but to actually just have a hit and miss situation, we really want you people to be leaders on this issue. So that I think is response. We don't need the responses now, but I think that's what we're talking about. We realize long term we must capacitate, but at this stage I do not think our response system from you guys at Weather Services, and I'm not in that sense blaming you, because it's an overall government thing, but I think you people must play a much more forceful role and find more innovative ways to let people know that things are coming. I mean, these tornadoes and things that came, those things we should know much better, much quicker. Answer the rest of the questions?
Yeah, maybe I can just say that we do have a response system like that on cell phones, and although it's still in its infancy, and there is still a lot of work to be done in order to improve that. We do that, and there's a very close relationship that especially our forecasting office has with the disaster in structures within the in local government.
Well, I've definitely not received one, and I receive a weather forecast on my phone every day. Okay, so let's leave it at that. Okay. I think the point is we're not here for you to justify, we're here to try and direct you. Okay, the other questions?
Thank you, Chair. There was a question on whether the South African Weather Service would like to go solo with regard to coordination efforts of climate change and adaptation research. The answer to that is no. We would like to be in partnership with government departments and entities and research institutes. We already have an MOU with CSIR on various aspects of our operation, including air quality. We are also party to the access collaboration, and we've got a niche to play there. We do realize that we've got a unique role to play. As far as climate change is concerned, we've got sufficient resources and infrastructure which is geared towards adaptation to climate change. The forecast that we issue on a day-to-day basis is actually...
Whose phone is it?
A way...
It's his. It's his.
Who?
Okay.
Sorry about that. I thought I switched it off. So I was saying the forecast that we issue on a day-to-day basis goes some way towards adaptation to climate change, because we believe that climate change is not an abrupt process. It's something that happens gradually. Nico, do you have something else to add?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to add to what my colleague has said, in the sense that we do realize that the climate change research environment is very small in South Africa, and we can't afford to not work together. So that is, I can categorically say that we collaborate very strongly with the CSIR, and then also tertiary institutions like the University of Cape Town and the University of Pretoria, to conduct research on the long-term forecasting of climatic and weather events. But that the mandate of the Weather Service is that we are the, it's called the voice for the public on the forecasting of climate and weather events. And that is why we collaborate with these institutions, but the end product.
You're the first line of collecting the data.
Yeah.
That's your mandate in the legislation.
Yeah.
So
but
you have obviously an inside role as far as that's concerned. In terms of interpretation of that information and the analysis of it and so on, clearly more agencies will play a role.
Yeah, and we actually work together with them so that we have a consensus story to tell, and so that nobody is out of line, so to speak, and not telling what the data is showing us.
Is that all the questions?
There was a question on the wind atlas of South Africa and solar energy. I think the solar part has partly been addressed. We are in collaboration with CSIR, RISO in Denmark, and Saneri. To look at areas for potential of wind energy generation in South Africa. And another project that we are doing with CSIR relates to the site beefing up or increasing our wind infrastructure in the country, so that we've got coverage of wind energy infrastructure in the country that will inform us more on the available or potentially available wind energy in the country. Wind energy in the country is mainly more abundant along coastal areas for simple reasons that your roughness is lower along coastal areas. And your solar energy is more available on the western sections of the country, specifically over the Northern Cape. That's an area that has got a lot of sunshine in the country and has got a large potential relative to the rest of the country for the generation of solar power. But that does not mean that the rest of the country doesn't have that potential for solar energy. What I'm highlighting here is...
You just never get clouds in the west.
Yeah, it's
or little.
More sunny than the rest of the country. Mm. I don't know if Nico has something you'd like to add.
All right, Mr. Kalali, you didn't have a question, so I'm going to give you one question and then we'll move to the next input.
Chairperson, it's not a question. What?
That's on.
Chairperson, actually, it was not a question as such, but I'm happy that this early warning issues have been dealt with, though not 100%, as you said. Well, they can go, they can come back with their answers, because it mainly affects the a man on the street, where a man, the rural areas, you know. And there was one time whereby the source people promised to draft a book, Indigenous Methods, and the CEO knows about it, and we have been waiting for that book for I don't know how many years. It's just a message, Jefferson, to take home. We are still waiting for that Indigenous.
It has been written. It's called the Invisible Atlas. So when it appears on the shelves, you'll see it.
What?
It'll just be that Invisible Atlas.
Yes.
Now we'll keep them to account when they come and account for their budget. Ma, we'll keep them account then for that issue. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it always that agencies. Yes.
Can you answer that question?
You have an answer.
It was a comment, but can you?
If you have an answer, I mean, I was trying to protect you, but okay.
The Indigenous Knowledge book was published 2 years ago.
See, I told you, the Invisible Atlas.
I can make an undertaking that we'll ask the CEO to make a copy available to the portfolio committee. And
copies. I don't like the singular.
How many copies?
In fact, when you come here with your budget, you'll get into deep trouble, the fact that you didn't send it the region we had to ask for it. Speak to Chileka. She knows how many members of the committee there are, okay?
There was also a question on the 90% of disasters that are weather related.
Yes.
Where the 10% coming from? My colleague will be able to answer that question.
I thought the other 10 was from politicians, but okay.
Mr. Chairman, you are right. It's mainly from human sources, but also from geological origin, like volcanoes and earthquakes. And
fires, for example.
And fires.
These fires on Table Mountain, every year some fool drops a cigarette somewhere and the whole mountain burns up.
And then also high storm surges along the coast, but that is also indirectly related to weather.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Give my regards to your colleagues and CEOs and so on. Tell them we're waiting for them when they come with their budget, okay?
Okay.
All right. The next input is from Res Southern Africa, submission number 18. 18, where's 18? There we are. 18, and there is a slide presentation that looks like that. So all of you have that. It's a Mr. D. Ayling. Ayling, is that right?
Duncan, yeah. Thank you.
Good morning. The procedure of the committee is that you have 10 to 15 minutes to present the main points of your input, and the rest of the time will be taken up by questions by the committee. So welcome, thanks for being here, and you can start when you're ready.
Mr. Chairman, may I just mention something to the Weather Service before I leave?
No, this is not your place to make those. If you want to call them, okay? Or see them afterwards. This is not a place where you come and attack my people and make submissions. Okay, over to you. The time is tick-tock.
Honourable members, Mr. Chairman, thank you for inviting me here today. I come from a company called RES Southern Africa. RES stands for Renewable Energy Systems. I'm the head of development here for RES Southern Africa. As a very quick introduction to tell you who we are, We're one of the world's leading renewable energy developers. We have over 1,000 people working for our company around the world. We are based in the UK, and we've been developing wind farms for over 25 years. We've also active in solar, biomass, and building integrated renewables with over 5,000 megawatts of wind energy developed. But we don't just develop, we also operate and maintain, and we are an independent power producer. I've included a map of our offices around the world just to show that we are international, but we have a South African company based in Cape Town since 2009. I'm very much supported by the team in the UK, but we have plans and we very much hope to expand and employ South African people over the next few years. So, on to the comments on the climate change white paper itself. We are representing the view of quite a few wind energy developers, I would imagine. I am also part of SAWEA, the South African Wind Energy Association. I don't speak on behalf of SAWEA today, but this is our response. But we are very positive indeed towards the climate change white paper as it stands. We welcome the government's acknowledgement of its share in global climate change and its awareness of the urgency to act. We very much agree with the government's recognition of the polluter pays principle, but this, of course, must come with effective measurement and monitoring, otherwise it will not manage to achieve its goal. We very much agree with the government's policy to develop a win-win strategic approach that develops the economy alongside combating climate change. And we believe that to this end, the renewables industry will be crucial. We welcome the government's recognition that revenue generated by carbon taxation should be allowed to support climate change policy and including incentives for renewable energy development. I would just like to pause for a moment and point out how positive we are about the white paper as it stands. And we applaud the government for producing a quality document. Now the concerns. We believe that the timeline is too long. It mentions 2 to 3 years before measuring achievements. We recommend a quicker deadline of 1 year. And a timeline for each mitigation and adaptation measurement. As a result, industries would be able to measure their progress. There's a definition which we feel needs to be made of what is a significantly emitting sector. For the energy sector, it could, of course, be measured in terms of tons of CO2 emitted per megawatt hour of electricity generated. And there is an assumption in the white paper that the climate change policies will produce a net economic negative impact. Now, while we also agree that that is possible in the short term, I believe in the long term, the social and environmental benefits and economic benefits will take over and be positive. And it is this last point which I think I would like to labour on a little further. So the economy and number of jobs can benefit through climate change policy. In section 8.3, it mentions the Renewable Energy Flagship Programme and that the programme will be enhanced by domestic manufacturing potential. We very much agree. But that domestic manufacturing potential will require strong and sustainable domestic incentives. And it's without this manufacturing potential, we will lose the benefits of technology transfer and of job creation. And so,
just start with your company, for example, the technologies you use here in this country and in other countries. I mean, are they developed in those countries or they come from the UK?
They tend to be developed in those countries, Jeff.
So all the technology you use here, you've developed in this country. There's a factory that manufactures in this country.
No, sorry, not in this country. The turbines and the components that we are using in whichever country we're operating tend to be imported from the countries where they were manufactured, and that tends to be Germany, Denmark, Spain, America.
So to that flagship says the program will enhance domestic manufacturing potential. How in the renewable energy will we do that?
I would very much hope that my following slides would explain this, but it is through having strong and reliable policies that don't keep changing. If there can be certainty and a large enough market, then the manufacturers will come to South Africa and they will start setting up. In fact, we are seeing one or two coming right now in the hope that the market will be large enough. But those manufacturers, I believe, are taking a risk, and I applaud them for taking that risk. But the benefits in terms of jobs and economy to South Africa will only come if the market's large enough and policy certainty remains. Maybe I'll move on to that.
In that answer of yours, enlighten us why you think the IRP2 that's been adopted does not do exactly what you're saying.
This here is the IRP2, or the IRP 2010 revised balanced cumulative scenario for wind and renewable energy. The blue is the wind energy that the IRP says the South Africa will procure, and the red is a combination of wind and other renewables. Past 2019, there is no real certainty how much wind the IRP wants. And that's, of course, one uncertainty that industry is grappling with. We do applaud the IRP2. We like very much that it has been gazetted and that it shows what the government wants into the future. But we also understand that it can be revised every two or three years, so it is not set in stone. And, of course, we would very much like it to be revised upwards. But the question, of course, that I cannot answer, I'm not a turbine manufacturer, is this enough to bring manufacturing to South Africa and therefore the jobs and the economic benefits? What we do have is this, the Renewable Energy Independent Power Program, procurement for wind energy out to 2016. It's a very good start. But what happens afterwards, we're really not too sure. Of course, the IRP shows the way.
But you're not sure of?
What's going to happen after this first request for proposals. They're requesting 1,800...
Just explain to me, because I'm not too familiar. I mean, I'm trying to understand what your fears are. I mean, government sets down a policy. That policy is now entrenched in the white paper on climate change. We can argue whether it's enough or not enough and whether it's going to attract things. But what are the fears? I mean, any policy is open for review at any stage, in any country, anywhere in the world. So it's not a particular fear that you can raise for this country. So I'm trying to work out what the fear is. Just explain it to me.
There's the fear of the unknown, to be honest, and also the track record. I don't want to go over old ground, but there was a renewable energy feed-in tariff, which attracted international investors to South Africa, and in the past year that has been disappeared and replaced with a completely different program of bidding, competitive bidding, and with a cap on the megawatts. So what we thought, what international investors thought they were coming to South Africa for has literally been pulled out from underneath our feet. After the refit, the feeding tariff disappeared. We were then shown the new program with the bidding and the capacity cap. We have examined it. We still believe that we can do business in South Africa. So we are pleased that we have something on the table to work with that we believe we can work with. But this slide here is showing what we've got on the table that we're working with right now.
Are you scared that government's now going to change it again?
There is that fear, but also...
do you have that fear, say, for example, Britain ever?
Yes, we do.
You do?
Yes, okay. We do, Chair. In fact, it is a uncertainty common in many markets, but the more certain that a policy can be, the more likely it will be to succeed. So what I'm asking for, and I will be asking for in later slide, is some kind of announcement about what happens after this request for proposals in the Renewable Energy Independent Power Procurement Program. I'm sorry, I lost my track.
Well, you're on that slide there, and you were, and I was asking about the question marks and why you have the fears.
Yeah.
Which you've now said you also have for Britain, so it makes me feel much better. It's not just an African thing.
No, when the Labour government changed to Conservative government in the UK, then the renewable energy policy suddenly went uncertain, and now we're finding it's changing. But enough about the UK. The 1,850 megawatts of wind that is to be procured in this programme here in South Africa could very well be taken up by bids which go in March of 2012. What happens after that? Of course, it takes a few years, two or three years, to develop a wind energy project, so we're looking that far ahead at least.
And what does the bid give you? Sorry, you're bidding for a part of whatever market is opening up. Is that what you're bidding for?
Yes, you're bidding for an allocation of megawatts of that 1,800.
And then they give that to you, and you're worried how long that's going to last, that they're going to give it to you.
Now, if you succeed in the bidding program and you're allocated those megawatts, then you're very happy and you'll go ahead and you'll make a project.
Yeah.
But
whether you're going to get more is what's uncertain.
Yeah, there's a vast over-allocation of wind energy projects for that 1,850. So it's a very competitive market. There could be a lot more wind energy built in South Africa if that cap wasn't there. Of course, I understand the cap is there because you need to pay the levy, so you need to know how much money you're going to be paying out for that levy. This, the purple on the bottom is the same numbers from the IRP, and the green bit on top is what the South African Wind Energy Association and its members believe they can produce if they were allowed to. I was for the last year on the board of SWEA, and we consulted extensively with the members and came up with these numbers. 25% of renewable energy by 2025, and we believe in the Wind Energy Association that 20% of all electricity could come from wind by 2025 if we were allowed to. If we could either remove the cap, as some countries have done, and they've accepted whatever renewable energy can be delivered, or if the megawatt cap is raised. So, this is my request to government to announce that the Renewable Energy Independent Power Programme request for proposals of August 2011 will be followed by an RFP2 with an increased megawatt allocation or the removal thereof of the cap and a timeline for procurement, and to announce that subsequent additional RFPs will follow, showing the government's commitment to the RFP2 or RFP 2010. And this,
just before you go on, the RFP2 has moved, I can't remember the megawatts, is it 17,000 megawatts, is it? Chair? The renewables in the new IRP2, is it moved up to, I think it's 17,000 megawatts. Are you, well, whatever it is, let's say 70,000 for an example. Is in the bids you've made so far, is all the capacity for renewable energy in the IRP2, is it all included in those bids, that there'll have to be further promises, or is it partially, only a part of the ones that are in the RFP2, if you know what I'm trying to ask? What I'm trying to ask you, has the full capacity of renewables, as in the IRP2, is it part of already having been, letting you all squabble about what part of it you want, or is there still a part of it left and only a part of it's been allocated? Because, I mean, you know, whatever you answer me would be an answer to the request you made.
Okay, there's been nothing allocated yet.
But what part is being, the part you're bidding for, you're saying you're bidding for a particular slice,
mm-hmm.
is the whole allocation of renewables part of that slice? Or is there only 50% of the slice is now being allocated and some of it is being kept? What is the case?
Oh, the Renewable Energy Independent Program and the request for proposals that they're asking for now is a very small amount of the IRP's total. I think that's
so that's the question I'm asking. But then I'll get to the logic of it, is that obviously the rest of it has to be allocated later.
We very much hope so, yes.
Well, I mean, it just has to. I mean, it's a policy of government now that they 17,000 megawatts is going to be allocated to renewables. So, you know, it's pretty obvious. I think of that as about 6 or 7 to wind. I can't remember.
Yes.
But, okay, I'll get the full answers on that, because that a lot of what you're asking here depends on those questions.
Yes.
If government only, because it wants to start a process, only taken part of it, it's going to have to bid the rest of it at some stage, else it's not going to reach its targets. I mean, it's pretty obvious to me.
I very much agree, Chair. It's just what happens after this request for proposals.
Okay.
And it's quite soon.
Okay. No, it's fine. What you're really asking is government should maybe map out and just explain to the industry what its plans are without committing to specifics, but to say, well, of course, we'll roll out the rest of it in time to come and as we start going. Okay, so those are your requests. I understand what you're asking.
And that concludes my presentation.
Okay. Questions?
No.
Comments? Mr. Morgan?
Thanks very much, Chair. Thank you, Rez, for the thoughtful presentation. I think, Chairperson, it's certainly an interesting point. I mean, in order for us to stimulate the local content, the manufacturing production, which is spoken about in the new growth path for South Africa and is spoken about in the white paper, there has to be some market certainty of what the likely market is going to be over a period of time. Investors, I would imagine, going to the markets for capital are looking for 20-year time horizon. At least, I would think. Just by way of additional information, I spent some time in late September in Germany. I toured a bunch of renewable energy production facilities, and one of the facilities I toured was the Bosch solar facility in Erfurt, which was remarkable. It's high tech, 2,000 panels a day. It's really quite inspiring. And I got a similar response from Bosch as well, saying, we are so keen to come to South Africa, we really, really are, but we will replicate this exact factory in Erfurt in South Africa, provided we know that there is a long-term market, basically, to sell. And for the moment, we'll just import. And, you know, we can contest that. But, I mean, they, you know, unless it's a government-owned thing, I mean, the market, is going to respond like that. So I certainly take the point. I followed the refit issue very, very closely, and I was a big supporter of the refit. In fact, myself and two other MPs in late 2008 submitted a private members bill on refit. And I realize it's now gone to rebid. And I'm sure, as you would say, Chairman, policies can be re-looked at. But I presume you are from the United Kingdom. I'd be very interested, working now under rebid, which you are forced to work under, and presumably, and I am making presumptions here, that you have some experience of refit as well in your personal capacity. If you could actually just, in your experience, tell us the difference between the two, and give us an impression of the relative strengths or weaknesses of either of the two ways of pursuing renewable energy uptake in the world. And I'd be particularly interested if you could maybe give us one or two examples of refit in the United Kingdom, both things that have worked and both things that have not worked, quite frankly. I think that would be the fairest way for you to respond. Thank you.
Thank you. Good question. Anyone else? Chairperson in Jikalana?
Chair, just to reinforce what we're seeing, the what is regarded as RFP1, or the current procurement of renewable energy, is actually 3,725 megawatts out of an expected 10,000 megawatts. So obviously, the government will learn from this current procurement as how to move forward in the rest of the 10,000 megawatts. And I want to emphasize, you know, even for your benefit and the rest of the committee, that you may know, you may not know, the government is quite cautious because this is a greenfield project. You know, just last week when we were in UK, the very UK government is actually backtracking from its commitment of 20% of renewable energy. And in South Africa, we're not backtracking, but at least we're moving cautiously. I don't want to detract from the main focus of the meeting, Chair, but at least that must be understood, because I think the factoring in of renewable energy in this public area is how, to what extent are we really seeing that the white paper policy response is attempting, you know, to ensure that we move towards a cleaner, you know, energy, and therefore, you know, a reduction of greenhouse, you know, gas emissions. I'm sure, one way or another, the other presentations will articulate that. But from my side, when I look at this, I would definitely make my comments in due course. All I wanted to also check from Mr. Ayling as well is that, given the shift from refit to rebid, which took some of us, including myself, by surprise a little bit, there's still interest from investors. That was evidenced in the investors conference in the middle of September, where about 500 investors came. I just wanted to check, doesn't that indicate that even the shift itself, uneasy as it may have caused, or even if it had caused us uneasiness, doesn't that still show that at least even the concerns that he has around manufacturing, working together with the private sector, may overcome that? I know it's a little bit of a side issue, but it does contribute at the end of the day that we can have a cumulative effect to ensure that renewable energy becomes a more visible factor in due course, even addressing his question marks. Because all of that, from my experience, you know, is an issue. Because some of the local companies have already approached me. They say, look, if we want to ensure that we move meaningfully in the transition to low carbon economy, we must ensure local manufacturing. At the same time, you know, the impression that we got is that in spite of the shift from refit to rebid, was that we still attracted quite sizable investors. Thanks.
I also want to add that without detracting from the specific policies on the energy, because they're there, for me, the biggest plus you have as an investor is that graph that's up there. That is now what the white paper in South Africa has now bound us to as a country. And, you know, when people look at that, they say, what about it? It's very important that people analyze that thing properly. If you look at 1997, that's when we did the LTMS, whatever it was called, we were at 398 megatons. 13 years later, in 2010, we were on 547 megatons, which was last year. That is an increase of 149 megatons over a 13-year period.
government has now committed itself in the next 15 years from 2010 till 2025 to only 53 plus 14 is 67 megatons. An increase in those 13 years, we increased with 149. We've now committed ourselves in a bigger economy with more emissions now than we had 13 years ago, much more. We've committed ourselves to only grow with 67 megatons. Now, to do that, one doesn't have to be a genius to realize that you have to move from a high carbon economy to a low carbon economy. And one of the main ways of doing that is renewable energy. I mean, there's no genius involved in that. Obviously, pricing carbon. If anyone asks me, what is it you get from the white paper? It's that we now as a nation have decided in principle to price carbon. Through the carbon budget, through the carbon taxes, and all those things. So it is, we put, on the one hand, we've committed ourselves to a low carbon, and we're also punishing those that are the carbon emitters. So the policies of this country that have been adopted now in the energy field, including the white paper on climate change, which is the overarching policy for climate change, is all going in one direction. It's difficult for me to see that people, obviously I can imagine as an investor, one would be kind of cautious in terms of the nuts and bolts of it and how much you get. But in terms of, if I said to Eskom yesterday, and this is not good advice because you're now going to hear what I told them. I said, if I was them, and I was the monopoly in energy in this country, me, I wouldn't talk about coal again in my life. I'll just keep on the factories I've got until they burn out and so on. Me, if I'm Eskom, I become the biggest proponent of renewable energy. Because why? I'm a monopoly. I've got huge funds behind me. I've got huge everything behind me. The government policy is going in one way. They're not going to ever give us another coal-bearing power station. It's never going to be agreed to by government again. So, you know, all of it's going one way. So in terms of policies for me, my worry is not actually those policies. You know, you as investors may be worried. My worry is what happens in all developing countries. We never get never or almost never get the advantage of the manufacturing of things. If I was the energy sector and if ever I talk to them, my argument will be one thing. Only give big contracts to those people that actually commit themselves in the contract to come and put manufacturing. As this boss says, they'll come put a factory here. That's what I would do as a government. I would say to them, you only come here and you become a big player in renewable energy if you're prepared to build that factory here. And it makes it part of the conditions. Because otherwise, these words here, the program will be enhanced by domestic manufacturing potential, will never happen. If you do not force the manufacturers, because the problem is, there may be a lot of reasons why people wouldn't want to build a factory in South Africa. Some people argue labor, others argue tax, others say there's not the right skill levels, etc., etc. Whatever, I'm not going to get involved in those arguments. I'm assuming there may be valid reasons why you would rather go and put your factory in a place where there's low, they can pay low salaries, get skilled workers, and so. I mean, it makes logic to me as a capitalist. You're a capitalist, that's what you'll do. So if we do not force, as we start a new industry, we have to force that industry to make the right decisions up front. And the way to do that is, on the one hand, to say to them, okay, we'll give you a bigger slice of the pie, but then you must promise us at the same time. Only those that promise us they'll come and build a factory here with this kind of capacity will we give X amount of the renewable energy. If we don't do it like that, and so, you know, My comment or message is really twofold. Firstly, if you actually look at the policies and where this government is going, it's only going one way, and that's your way. Secondly, the big thing for me is that you as an industry must also find ways of telling government, not give us more certainty. You must start finding ways to say, if you actually do this, we'll bring manufacturing to this country. We're not going to buy our machines from Belgium and Germany, etc., etc. We are prepared to come and put a factory here. And so
I mean, you must. I can't tell the industry what to do. I can tell Eskom what to do because we shareholders in Eskom, and I think they're being foolish. What they're doing. But with you guys, the way to capture this government's attention is by telling us how you're going to create jobs. So if you come with proposals, I'm sure this committee is going to be very supportive, if we're not already supportive of the renewable energy initiatives. But we are really going to be supportive of the mechanics of it if you also come and tell us how it is that we're going to make sure that those things are manufactured in this country and not just the money, you're going to come here, invest some money, and then take it all out of the country again. So that is really two tips I would want to give, if I am allowed to abuse the chair, which I in any case will do when I'm sitting there. Any other questions? Okay, those are your issues you can respond to.
Thank you, Chair. Shall I return to the first question?
Okay, anyone, any order you want to answer them?
Well, Honourable Morgan, the refit versus rebid was the first question and the pros and cons thereof. It does actually lead into the response to the Honourable Nizika, the Chair of Energy. But the refit is where a guaranteed income for your electricity that you produce is given, guaranteed tariff. Going forward for the lifetime of your project. It's a very certain thing to offer to industry. And if you're wanting to kickstart a new industry, a new and potentially risky new industry, because it is a greenfield type industry in South Africa, it has not been done before here, the actual costs are relatively unknown. We can predict, but it hasn't been done here before. There are a few turbines, of course, I think 7 or 8, but these are not commercial wind farms at all. So it hasn't been done here before. And the feed-in tariff just takes away one of those uncertainties for the industry when they're coming in, because they know the income they're going to get. It's, I think, as simple as that on the feed-in tariff side of things. And it's very good for kick-starting new industry. The rebid, or is kind of the slang of what we're calling it, is a bidding process, and it's capped as well. So the big difference is a true feed-in tariff is not capped, and it's a certain tariff. The bidding process, you have to competitively bid on the tariff that you're going to get for that electricity you produce. It's a way of forcing down price, which is good in a mature market. In an immature market where you don't actually know the true cost, you're going to force down prices to a point where you're competing possibly on an unfeasible level. Now, there is in the program put forward by the Department of Energy a large emphasis on the banks to check our bids to make sure that they are feasible. And the banks, I have a fair amount of trust in. I think they will be able to do that due diligence quite well. But again, it's putting a lot of responsibility on the bank's shoulders to make sure that they don't let any projects go through that have bid too low and will not actually be able to reach financial close or ride out the bumps along the way after financial close to produce a quality project. So the feed-in tariff is good, especially for immature markets. The bidding process is good once you have a mature market to force the price down. I think in South Africa, we're adding a bit more risk because it's an immature market and it's a bidding process. Now, leading on to the question of, well, there still remains a lot of interest, as you said. A lot of interest was sparked by the feed-in tariff, and a lot of investment was made in terms of effort and money. By some companies already. Some companies are not as large and able to support themselves as the one I work for. Some developers are relatively small developers and they have remortgaged their houses to keep going in this market. They can't withdraw. They're stuck. They have to make a success. project. So even though the framework and program has completely changed, they are committed because they have no other option. For ourselves, who are a large company, we still believe very much in the signals being sent by the government that this is the direction that South Africa wants to go. So we're playing the long game. We believe that there will be ups and downs and the details that we have to work out, but we are a large enough company to be able to possibly miss out on the first request for proposals. It's very competitive. We might miss out on it, but we'll be there for the next time. The resource here in South Africa is very good. The demand, energy demand here is huge, and for the neighbouring countries around that South Africa is linked to. So the prize is definitely worthwhile being here for my company. And that's why we are still interested and still here. If I'm moving on to the Mr. Chairman, your comments on forcing industry to manufacture here. We do support the local content criteria that are in the bid requirements from the Department of Energy. We do support the need to bring the benefits to the country that we're operating in. I'll just point out that we are not a manufacturer of components or turbines. We are a developer, we are an operator, maintainer.
Yeah, but decisions you make a big difference on that. Mm. If you show no trust in the component that a country makes, and you only trust Belgian ones, for example, products, makes a huge difference. You make a huge impact. And all I'm suggesting is that I think we, as a government, must be smarter. We must tie you guys down to more. There's a lucrative market, and we must make sure that the thing is South African from the beginning. So, you know, all I'm saying to you is I don't really expect you to answer. I would suggest to you that you should, where you can talk in the industry, you should push them in that direction, number one. Number two, as far as this committee is concerned, and obviously people have different views on it, but it's one of the things that's where we would be pushing in that direction on this issue. So, you know.
No, Chairman, I'm in full agreement, and we do push for that. The only one element of caution that I know my CEO would say, as he did say to a delegation of MPs that visited our offices in London recently, is that it is a global market that South Africa is competing in. And if it becomes too difficult to operate, then the investment will go elsewhere.
Not really, but okay. You have to say that. That curve there, and with all the potential this country has for growth, says you won't leave. But we must not make it unduly onerous for you.
Thank you.
Okay, I thought that was a useful input. Nice. It's nice to engage with issues we don't deal with all the time. Unfortunately, you would have had a lot of sweetheart questions if one of our colleagues, Mr. Grayling, was here. He's not here, so you had no sweetheart questions today. All right. The Ikasi, where is Ikasi? These are the fellows that don't know how to read their watches. Unfortunately, committee, we're going to just have to sit and at least give them a chance to present. It's up to you how much time you want to use. But the gentleman from Ikati, who is he, Mr. Nshingilane? We frown upon the fact that you come here late, that you've messed our program up, and that we have to now sit during lunchtime to listen to you. But in the spirit of sacrificing and caring MPs, we're going to sacrifice our lunch today to give you a chance to give your input, and then we'll see if there are any questions. So please jump straight into your input. Don't even apologize or anything. Don't thank my ancestors. Leave them alone. Just go into your input and make the main points, and
Let's try and see how quickly we can do your input. You haven't got a PowerPoint. The submission is number 6. 6, okay? Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Chef. We will try to be just straight to the point in terms of our input. We'll jump some of the things. Firstly, Chairperson and the committee, our concern as a gas development project, we are concerned about the number of time bound in the proposed white paper. We would like to propose a short-term implementation of 3 years instead of 5 years, as this white paper proposed. So our reason for that is that we think the huge impact, the damage is directly affecting people now, so we need to speed up the implementation of the policy. Another proposal will be, because the white paper is proposing 20 years, medium term of 20 years, so we think as a CASI it should be 10 years instead of 20 years. Then also the long term period planning should be 2030 instead of 2050, because there's quite a long planning, so we felt that no, we need to try and push things a bit faster, because these issues are currently affecting the people, especially the people in rural areas and the poor. Then we have another recommendation, because we're hoping to see it on the white paper, the issue of Ministry of Climate Change. We are actually proposing that there should be a ministry that will deal with the issue of climate change, that will directly deal. We are aware that the Department of Environment, Mental Affairs, they do have a certain directorate that deals with climate change, but we feel that it is not good enough, because at least the directorate is not making enough impact in terms of dealing with these issues of climate change. So we need at least a specific ministry that will deal with climate change related issues. We also would like to propose the provinces and the municipalities, because there's a lack of capacity with the provinces and the municipalities in terms of knowledge and awareness of climate change. So we feel that the national department is not really doing enough in terms of empowering those entities of government. I'll try and jump some things. Then the issue of renewable energy, I think it's quite interesting, because the last speaker was speaking about the renewable energy proposal. So also we feel that there's a lack of support in terms of from the government side in terms of the renewable energy project, because we don't see anything coming out in terms of coming up with the other options, unlike the ESCOM and the, but we can see that the ITC is trying to come up with some funding in terms of supporting the renewable energy project. And the deputy president, we've noticed that he was in Denmark in terms of trying to negotiate the wind energy project that Denmark is proposing to do in South Africa. I'll be short in the nuclear energy. We are opposed to the nuclear energy, but because we are aware that there is a project that is started here in South Africa. So as a gas actually, we don't think it should continue, because we have a fear that in the next few years, 10 to 15 years, we'll have something like the Japan situation, whereby there was many people died, and so we feel that we are actually against with the nuclear energy. What we are proposing the introduction of carbon capture and storage technologies that will help to reduce greenhouse emissions. I'll move to the agriculture and commercial forestry. we've noticed that here, especially in Soweto, because we are from Soweto, most of the households in Soweto, they don't do the vegetable gardens and the care. So we are quite worried because now, which means that there will be a demand for food and there will be also a short of supply of food. And obviously the price will, because we know that even farming communities have been affected by...
What worries me is this thing, because somehow if you look at provincial governments, if you go to provincial governments that are in more rural areas, say Transkei, you know, the Eastern Cape, the name for Transkei, there they will encourage gardens and so on. But somehow the provinces that are in urban, you know, like Gauteng, you never, when you go there, you never hear them actually encouraging the agriculture department, encouraging backyard. Just the most amazing, bizarre way of, like we always think, well, if you're in a rural area, you must plant things, but if you're in a more urbanized area, you shouldn't have. Just as a weird way of thinking, I don't know how it's got into our mindset.
Yeah, actually, the Gauteng Department of Agriculture is trying to mobilize people to come up with they call it urban farming. Yeah, whereby they encourage people to, especially young people, to do poultry farming and also planting like cabbage, potatoes, spinach, those things that could be. Yeah, but now it's not. I don't think it's gonna, because the way they do it, the awareness is not good enough. That's what I can say. Because they've been talking about this since the past 3 years, but we don't see any impact on.
Chairperson, it is the national government that does not. I've been fighting that, telling them that Gauteng has a fully fledged department, agriculture.
I'm going to give you a chance to say all this. Are you number one on my list?
Now? Okay, Bob.
The reason for that, because we feel that because there is a possibility of high food prices, because currently we are feeling that like that pressure in terms of prices going very high in terms of food. So we think there is a need for people to be encouraged to, because even the census questionnaire was also asking about whether the household is planting anything like cabbage, spinach, and but most of the people, they are not involved in those activities, so it really worries us as the conversation.
5 minutes left.
Okay, I'll just push. Okay, I'll go to the issue of awareness in terms of climate change, because I know the Department of Water and Environment was supposed to be champion this thing of awareness. The awareness thing is we are quite disappointed, because we are hoping that by now there will be, at least people will be aware of what climate change, because even the minister was on TV last time. People were so surprised, they didn't even know anything about climate change, because not even about the conference, but just about climate change, that awareness is quite, there's a lack of awareness in terms of people being informed about the issues related to climate change.
Do you know about the climate change train?
Yes, I do know about the...
Problem.
Yeah, I know, it was in Gauteng on Tuesday. I'm aware, but most of the people, they are not... I'm aware because I've been engaging with the department. Also, the issue of partnership with government, the NGOs, and I think there's still a lot to be done in terms of trying to ensure that government, at least they form a key partnership with the local NGOs, especially in the environment and climate change issues. I'll go to human settlement and urban settlement. So in Gauteng, this thing is very important, because in Gauteng there's an issue of urban people moving to Gauteng, and now then the Department of Housing will tell you that there's not enough space for the land. They can't find land to build houses. And so we think that the government, if it can try and develop rural areas, so we won't be having people all over the country going to Gauteng, because some of the provinces are not developed enough. So we think at least the Department of National Human Settlement should do something about the move with the population, in, like going all of them in Gauteng. And we've proposed that during the summit, provincial summit, climate change summit, that the Department of Human Settlement, in terms of trying to tell people to save water, there must be water tanks in each and every RDP house, so that we, because people now they're just wasting water and they don't know exactly why people should stop wasting water, because they don't know whether we have shortage of water or not. So I think we've explained that to the Department, Housing Department of Housing, that they must try now from the next financial year to do to install those water tanks in each and every RDP house in Gauteng, also in the national level. And then I'll jump to adaptation. In adaptation, as ECASI, we feel that poor countries will be more affected by climate change. Therefore, we recommend a pro-poor adaptation policy when the team from South Africa will be negotiating at COP17. They should push for that pro-poor adaptation policy.
You've got 2 minutes?
2 minutes left. Then I will talk about the water conservation and the demand management flagship program, which is on the white paper. There was a scenario during the provincial climate change summit in Gauteng. So there was a scenario whereby the Midval municipality. They told us that they tried to do like some awareness, social awareness, about the importance of saving water in communities, especially in the townships. So that initiative worked for them because they managed to save about 60 million, I think it's last year, because people, they were encouraged not to irrigate their gardens a lot, not to use water wisely. So I think that if other municipalities can try and implement that, that will help in terms of water shortage, because we know in Gauteng there's a lot of water shortages are there, so it's something that we need to focus on. I think there was something that I would like to comment the chairperson, because you said something about naming the people who are not saving energy. So we support that, and also the ones who are not also even government departments, yes. So companies also. So we fully support that, Honourable Chair, that those people should be named and shamed, so that.
And Parliament.
Yes.
Parliament.
Yes.
See which MPs like the
Yes, yes, yes. Because the issue. Yeah, because you mentioned something like lights, they're always on at night and stuff like that. So I think people we need to change our mindset in terms of, yeah, because those small things, they contribute to bigger things. So I think so.
Okay, thank you. I think you've got a good structured submission, actually. Having just played through it now, I thought you put some good work into it, so congratulations. You're not good with timekeeping, but you seem to be all right with structuring your submission. Any questions, any comments? Seems quite clear.
Ms. Zikilala was first, and she rudely interrupted me, ma'am.
Okay,
then,
thanks.
And then
Mr.
Tese. Okay, ma'am, Chairperson. In fact, I don't want to go back to the complaints. I just want to go much forward. What I'm saying, I would request Mr. Chingelana to try and motivate our municipalities in Gauteng, because they don't want to give the people land, just a small piece of land for them to try and have their vegetable gardens. I've applied at the end when everything was fine. It just went down. The last man who was to issue the paper for the women club to. It never happened. But what I am saying, like Eburuleni, that practice is very good when it comes to these vegetable gardens. The Eburuleni are looking after that. But it is not enough. But what I'm saying, maybe it would be good if one can visit you wherever you are, just to have a lengthy, because I cannot do it here. You see now? Just to have a lengthy discussion with you, just to report what is actually worrying the Gauteng people, as you might think they are not interested in having these. There was some education that they say they don't have land. Fine. But now you use the old tires. Do you know that one?
Yes, yes, I know.
You use the refuse, the refuse bags, you have those, you use the old bags with the, you know?
Yeah.
Yes, that is what we had. But I'm saying, because unfortunately you'll find that the committee itself does not understand. So I won't say much, except that I just get to where you are, because I understand you better. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yes, you're very militant today. You insulted this committee, they don't understand. Okay. That's my dad.
Sorry for that.
That's fine.
To the emerging farmers. So I wanted you to elaborate more on that, because I know of various assistance that the department is providing to emerging farmers. There is a scheme whereby they assist people to get farms. There is a grant whereby they assist farmers to acquire these crops and whatever. Another one for the equipment. And it's not a loan, it's a grant. So when you say there is a lack of support from the Department of Agriculture, I really get confused as to what's happening now, because I know of these things that the department has been providing. So maybe there is something that we don't know. So can you at least elaborate more on that? So yesterday you said you've been trying to engage the Department of Environment and Water Affairs, but you don't tell us as to what was it that you wanted to engage the department on. We just said we are worried, we've been trying to engage the department since April until today. So nothing is, you haven't got a response as soon as we are saying. So can you tell us as to what is it that you wanted from the department, and what frustrations did you meet? Another issue, you spoke of the people in Soweto who are unwilling to grow vegetable gardens. As a Kasi development project, working with the people on the ground, what did you do to encourage people to do that? Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Tracy.
Yes, sir, during this time, we don't talk a lot. The sugar levels have gone down. Yeah. We'll be happy if FKC could also go to schools. You know, every January, we do school visits, not only in January, but January is the time whereby we intensify the visits. And I think 2 out of 10 schools have vegetable gardens, and we have huge, huge lands where schools are, you know, situated. The yard, the school yard is very big. And I don't think that needs, you know, some kind of a meeting, because that's what we talk about every time we go there. And on the vegetable gardens for, you know, residents, we also take into consideration watering gardens, if they have enough water to water those gardens. But it is very important that you don't rely on supermarkets. You know, you buy stuff that has been there for I don't know how long, and the chain as well, you know, the chemicals that are being used for them to grow faster. But with us, we do the old way, which is very healthy. And I don't know how many agricultural colleges we have in the country, because that will also help that if we have students in numbers going to agricultural colleges, it will, you know, motivate them. And for human settlement, I don't know if this one will win, the department will win. You know, many opportunities are in Gauteng and other, you know, networks like KZN as well. They have a city, Cape Town as well. So people are forced by circumstances to go where opportunities are. And unfortunately, houses cannot be built every day. That's a problem. And also a contradiction that is not man-made. As we, you know, do this land grading, informal settlements, we make fires, we have to cook, we have to get hot water, and the methods we are using are not assisting, but people don't have a choice sometimes. So it's a very difficult situation that we are trying our best, but we cannot say much. And also rural development, we have to focus on that so that people, you know, come to cities on their own, not being forced by circumstances, because if the rural areas are developed, there will be employment there. But because they're looking for opportunities, they don't have a choice. They just have to move to Gauteng, and they like Gauteng of all the provinces. It's small, but the population there, yeah, it's unbearable. Thank you.
You made a lot of comments about speeding things up. I want you to look at that diagram. That diagram is an indication of what we have promised in the white paper. If we just keep growing with all the fossil fuels that we have now, we'll grow somewhere in that orange line. It can be right up top there, it can be further down. We'll probably be somewhere in the middle. But what our government has committed ourselves is to the green, that trajectory of green, that band of green. We say over that period, we're not going to grow like the orange, but we're only going to grow like the green in terms of our emissions. Now, you are suggesting we must speed that up even more. Now, look at that right on the left. You see 1997. At that stage, we measured our carbon. It was 398 megatons. By 2010, we reached 547 megatons. So in those 13 years, our economy grew with the amount of emissions grew with 149 megatons. Now, if you look from 2010 to 2025, that's 15 years, it's almost the same period as that. We're only allowing for a growth of 67 megatons, less than 50% growth than we grew in the previous 13 years. Our economy in 2010 is much bigger, we're emitting more, and we've only promised to grow with 67 megatons in the next 15 years, whereas we grew in the previous 13 years with 149 megatons. Now, I always ask people, if you're quite serious about telling us how to speed it up, how do you want us to speed up on that? Okay. Those targets, let me tell you, are impossible. I can sit here now and tell you, we cannot, in 15 years, we cannot cut our more than 50% our amount of emissions. That's what we promised. Now, when people come here and say to us, well, we must speed this up, where must we speed? How are we going to speed it up? What kind of economic growth are we going to have in the next 15 years? But we've already only committed ourselves to grow with 67 megatons of emissions extra. From there onwards, it's only downhill. You can see it goes down. So it's even less. Therefore, I ask people when they come and say, but cut the timeline, where do we cut it? Just explain to us where.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think the problem, Honorable Chair, is that there is this thing in South Africa whereby the policy, maybe the policy is signed, and now the delay, there's a lot of delay between the policy, when the policy is signed and the implementation. So it takes sometimes more than 5 years. So that was the worry from us as a council, that if we say maybe 15 years or 20 years, then it might be 30 years, 10 years more than that. So that's our main concern there, because the implementation, it takes very long to any policy to be implemented. So that's our concern, actually. Too. Yeah.
But you see what the problem is?
Because on paper, it's...
Just because we waited too long as a country, and the world hasn't even... No one in the world has agreed to that yet. Only us, basically. So you can see why we must be very careful what we're doing. I mean, if we try and go faster than this, we will absolutely destroy our economy. And there won't be any transition from a high carbon to low carbon if we don't give some space. Already, as I said, those targets for me are impossible. I just don't know how we would ever change from a high fossil fuel economy so quickly within 15 years to cut our emissions by more than the growth in more than 50%. So, but I hear what you're saying. All of us are always worried about things going to sort of. I also think we must, as a nation, look at what we promised. Okay, the other questions and other comments that people have raised, what are your responses?
I'll try and respond the issue of the engagement with the Department of Environment, and you said what was the proposal to the department. Actually, we wanted to push the issue of social mobilization, because if you look at Soweto, there's no awareness there around Soweto, and now so we're worried that since we are the only organization that is trying to be active in terms of the issues related to climate change and environment. So we're trying to at least tell the department that we must try and speed up this, because we came up with the proposal and gave it to them and say, here's the proposal, and they like the proposal. But now, you know, the issue of coming back to us, so it took them, I think it's about 6 months now to come back to us and respond and say, because they told us the feedback that they like the awareness proposal, but up to now, so... That's why we are a bit disappointed about the issue. Yeah.
Okay. The other issue, right?
The land. Okay. The issue of land. I know it's quite a challenging issue. It's a national issue that one of
land.
Yeah. Yeah. So in Gauteng, it's a very serious thing, and now, but I'm hoping that we'll be able to engage and maybe sit down and try and to come up with some strategy to deal with that, because that the issue of land is also challenging. That's why also in the question of schools, you asked me about schools, and that's our main objective to target school, because we are working with one school currently. It's a primary school in Soweto. We are trying to help the kids, to encourage them to plant, especially cabbage, spinach, onions, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but now there's also a need for technologies, because sometimes we need to put something in terms of the heat in Gauteng. It's quite hot, because even today it was very hot since yesterday. So the heat also, I'm not sure whether the issue of climate and what, but now the temperatures are a bit high. So the rain also, because sometimes you have floods and you don't. So it's quite challenging to agriculture and hunting also. So those issues. What else?
Just on that score of land with the schools, there was a year when the holding provincial government, they targeted the schools which were situated in the most poor area, people who were surrounding, because they would take everything, tools, seed, drinks, and everything. They started the garden so that the community was going to gain from there. The school would sell to the community on a low, you know, yes. So, and I heard you saying it's only the RDP areas that must be given those tanks. And what about the others?
If I may ask.
Yeah.
Ah, you're very distracted today. No intervention, this is another issue.
No, that's Chakasan. I'm telling the truth.
Sit quietly. finish the questions and then respond to Mama, please.
I think the last question was about Gauteng Department of Agriculture, if I'm not correct. That you felt that there are so many programs.
That they weren't supporting. And he was asking, but there are programs.
Yes.
Are you saying those programs are not working?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to ask, because I like that he said that there are programs in Gauteng in terms of the plans. But now, the issue of those programs, people applying for those things and getting those things, another issue. So I think the problem is there, because the problems are there, but sometimes they will tell you about the issue of lack of funding and stuff like that. So sometimes I don't know, because actually maybe it's an issue of funding, because the programs are there. Because I've engaged, and there's a cooperative in my area that they've engaged with the Department of Agriculture to try and do some farming. Like they used this vacant land, but that process took very long. So you know Gauteng, the structure of Gauteng, there are different opportunities. So if maybe, especially young people, if they want to do something, you need to speed up the process of assisting them. So if you take long, then there will be a problem of maybe they will, by then, after 6 months time down the line, they will say no, we are no longer interested in that. So the timelines also are very important when you apply for those kind of support
programs. Your problem is that you don't want to follow the group process. You just want everything to be done the way you want them to be.
No.
Not the way you want them to be.
I would say no.
Not the way the department has set processes. And then when they follow those processes, you will say they are wasting time. And then you are no longer interested in engaging the department because they took time.
No, okay, let me just clarify that. What I'm trying to say, when you deal with young people in any sector, especially because there was a summit, I think it was a food summit in Gauteng, I think in 2008, they were encouraging young people to do farming, to be involved in agricultural activities. But now, when young people go to the department, then it was like another story, like it was very difficult for them to access those funds. Because I normally...
You want the material?
Because I'm normally...
No polemic about it.
Because this is the condition
to the white paper. It's a specific issue of agriculture. We must not fight agriculture battles here in environment.
The issue here is one. These young people, they want things to be done the way they want them to. They don't want to follow the right processes. Look, if the department says we are providing 1, 2, 3. And these are the processes to be followed. So whether you are the youth or you are old or what, we have to go through all those processes. And now you become impatient. You say when you are dealing with youth, you have to do things fast. If you are going to do things the way you want us to do them, definitely we are not going to follow the right procedure. Tomorrow someone would say, no, there is corruption here.
Irregular expenditure.
Someone was doing something that he was getting they call it what? Black. Black plastic behind under the table. It's a black plastic, yeah. So people will say no. Something is fishy. One is benefiting somehow because procedures were not followed. So I'm appealing to you, to the youth in fact, to say, don't be impatient. Follow the right procedure, and you will get whatever you want. Don't be impatient. That's my plea.
Okay.
Because I don't find.
He's saying that impatience leads to expulsion. In general terms, I'm not raising a specific example.
Well, it's not going to be frustrating. You frustrate yourself by being impatient.
No, thank you. Brother.
You know what this one is?
Rotate.
The red card.
Yeah.
Impatience leads to red card. Red card. Patience reaches the green card, and you structured and managed the process. It has disadvantages. We always like, as Mr. Matebe has told you, we would all like to just, but can you imagine, once you start saying, take the procedures away, can you imagine the scope we leave for corruption?
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're saying to those officials now, don't follow the procedures. Now the money is not going to go to the community. The officials are going to take the money and say, oh, we streamlined this thing.
Mm.
So we've given, so they say, who you gave it to. So now we can't remember the guy's name. We just gave him a bag of money because we wanted to quickly let him make fun. That's the reality of it. As soon as you start taking shortcuts in government, you just open up a can of worms. The other thing, of course, will happen. I can bet you, Mr. Matebo will tell me, if we did it like that, only the official's friends will benefit.
Mm.
You'll get all his friends. Ma Bengu, Ma Tetsi will all come and make nice little backyard gardens. But the rest of the community will not get it. So that is why it's important that there's a paper trail, that there's a record of what happened. Exactly so that someone can check it, someone can hold people to account. We don't have, and I must tell you, it's a pain in the back. A lot of these processes, all of us have gone through. You apply for a permit, you apply for a license, it takes forever. But the problem is, you know, you were saying, I was listening to you about the department. I don't know what happened with you and the department. But if you had a project, I know what problem. It goes to the official who spoke to you. Then it goes to that official's boss. Then it goes to that official's boss. Then until it gets up to the minister. That's all the way it must go. Now the minister can't just say, I'm waiting for Ikasi's project proposal. It lands on the... You know, I ask for information on the dam in my constituency. I asked for this information almost a year ago. Every time I ask them, where's that information? At an end, I've asked them information. They tell me, no, it's still being pushed. It still hasn't been signed off by everyone. That's the problem with government, is that on the one hand, it's a pain, as Peter, Mr. Matebe demonstrated very nicely. On the one hand, it's an absolute pain to go through. But when you start not doing those things, it is just... It gets much worse. Because then you've got no chance of getting money. If there are no proper procedures that we can see who signed for what, from that moment on you will not get money. It's only the friends of that official who get it. So I think that's what we're saying.
Mm.
I mean, but that doesn't mean, sometimes there are procedures in government that are very slow, and it's not necessary for it to be that slow. So no one is excusing that. But to do away with the procedures to say, it's just, if we do that, we're in a banana republic. In fact, anywhere you go and look at corruption, that's what happens. People start taking shortcuts. So I think Mr. Matebe has quite correctly pointed out to us what the issues with the problem is. Although he's taken my lunch to do so. Okay, you finished with those? Any other ones you want to respond to?
I don't know. I think I'm trying to cover most of the...
Thank you very much, and I want to urge you, although it's difficult, I want to urge you,
whatever difficulties you have with government, don't give up. I mean, we all fall for this democracy. We'll almost make it try and work better. And what we are saying to you as a committee, we don't accept all the delays that take place. A lot of delays are not because of the procedure, it's because it's man-made or woman-made. Usually it's a man. I don't know many women that delay things. When they shop and they do things, they do it quick and they spend all your money very quickly. So it's usually men. But and so those things we don't excuse. But what we will not, what we don't also is for the procedures to be ignored. And sometimes we'd rather let you go through procedures take longer. But the kind of work you're doing, we appreciate it. The fact that we may debate with you these things, not that we don't. I mean, there's a lot of things we actually disagree agree on, and very little that we disagree on. So please keep up the good work, and just learn how to fly in planes on time. Okay. All right. Okay, we're adjourning. We had a good day on the public hearing. We've got 1 week of public hearings. The members will be happy to know that we've taken away next Friday. We're only sitting Tuesday and Wednesday. We've moved everything to Tuesday and Wednesday next week. So we're finishing the public hearings next week, Wednesday and Tuesday. Starting Tuesday, 8 o'clock, and we're looking for a venue still, okay? All right, I think that's it. Anyone have any issues to raise? Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.
Oh.
No, Mary.
9 o'clock.
I don't know why I said 9 o'clock. Sorry.